So climate change and environmental protection is a huge part of the work that we do. And obviously, the two are so interrelated. I mean, there's nowhere for animals to live if we deforest everywhere and, major land clearing, habitat loss. It's a massive thing for animals. And obviously, we also recognise humans as animals.
Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast, the show where we interview businesses and specialists to explore what can be done to reduce our impact on the planet and live more sustainably. You're here with Gareth and Anchor.
So today we have a Member of Parliament joining us.
I know, it's great, isn't it?
It is indeed. And as we talk about climate change, we also have to recognise the close relationship between our ecosystem and health and welfare of our wild animals.
Absolutely. I mean, we often hear the phrase, if the wild dies, we die. If the oceans die, we die.
Indeed, we hear this more and more. We actually have some stats on the percentage of wild animals left on our Instagram and Facebook pages if you'd like to check them out, and we'll post some more. She is a member of the New South Wales Legislative Council and a strong animal rights advocate. She established and chaired several inquiries into the use of battery cages for hens in the egg production industry, recommending a phase out of battery cage hen farming. Also chairs an inquiry into the exhibition of exotic animals in circuses and exhibition of cetaceans in New South Wales, where she serves as a deputy chair. She is also a strong opponent of Australian Ag laws, the New South Wales Government Right to Farm Bill, and increased biosecurity legislation.
So let's get straight to it and welcome Emma Hurst to the show. Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. I'm here with Emma Hurst, New South Wales MP for the Animal Justice Party. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So could you tell us a little bit about the Animal Justice Party and sort of how it came to be?
So the Animal Justice Party was founded in 2009, and it really came about, I was working in animal protection movement at the time already, but we were really frustrated by the lack of political action for animals. Most people are aware of the issue with the greyhound racing, with the backflip there, with the continual ignoring from government of what happens in the live animal export industry. And we just felt that there was no other political party that was really taking these issues as seriously as they needed to in that political atmosphere. So the Animal Justice Party was founded. It was founded in the offices of Animal Liberation in Sydney, New South Wales. And it grew from there. And there was a whole lot of range of people that got involved early on, people who were wildlife carers, people who were animal campaigners like myself. I was working directly in campaigns at the time, particularly around issues around farmed animals. It just sort of grew from there. And we grew very, very quickly as a political party. We got Mark Pearson elected in our first state election. We got Andy Medic elected in the second Victorian election, and I got elected in the second New South Wales election. And now we've also got a couple of councillors in Victoria as well.
So it's a swift growth then.
Very quick. And I think that really shows that, you know, it wasn't just a small group of people that were getting frustrated by the lack of laws to protect animals, that this was something that the mainstream was concerned about as well.
Before we get on to the politics as a whole of Animal Justice Party and what you do, we'd really like to know a little bit about you, where you came from, how you started. Obviously, you mentioned a little bit there, but sort of how do you think you developed into somebody who wants to do and is doing what you're doing now?
I take my story all the way back really to when I was quite a young girl, and I actually have a vivid memory of sitting down and holding a hen in my arms, and I was patting this hen and the hen was purring, and I realized that this hen shows joy in the same way as my rescue cats at home showed joy. And it occurred to me, even just as a young child, I think I was about 6 or 7, that if I couldn't go home and eat my cat, then I couldn't eat this hen. And I remember going home and writing letters to my parents and telling them that I wanted to go vegetarian. And they were quite supportive of that. But it was, I was kind of like an ignorant vegetarian, because I had no idea what was happening outside of just the life and death of animals, but actually what was happening in intensive animal agribusiness. And it wasn't till many years later, I was literally just walking down the street and somebody handed me a flyer. I was studying psychology at the time. And somebody handed me this flyer, and I went home and I researched online about what happens in the egg industry, that, you know, all male day-old chicks are macerated, organic and free-range as well, and that in the dairy industry, the calves are taken away so that human beings can breastfeed and take their milk. And I really went vegan overnight. And I also knew at that moment that I really wanted to dedicate my life to this. And I decided to stay in psychology because my theory was that animal cruelty was human-caused, and therefore the solution needed to be human-focused as well. So I ended up doing my master's in health psychology, which focuses around how do we convince people to change their behaviors? How do we convince entire populations to quit smoking or wear seatbelts or not speed when they're driving? And I thought that if I could learn those aspects of health psychology and use that understanding and pull it into my animal campaigns and the work I was doing there, that we could see significant changes for animals. So I ended up working for just over 10 years at Animal Liberation as the campaigns director. I worked at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals in media. And I also worked for World Animal Protection International, doing assessments on the campaigns and the effectiveness of behaviour change on those campaigns before I got into politics where I am now.
Fantastic. Your whole career has been around protecting animals. If that started from when you were studying, it's from then on, it's been entirely about the protection of animals and a better environment.
Not entirely. I did, while I was at university, I was working part-time in other aspects as well. I've worked as a child therapist. I spent many years working as a drug and alcohol counsellor. I've worked in psychiatric hospitals. And I've worked in nursing homes as well. So I do have quite a strong background working with people and caring for and protecting people as well. And I think that, you know, so a lot of that work that I did, I also worked in research as well at the University of Western Sydney. So I think a lot of those jobs, I was doing that part-time while I was also studying and also working within animal spaces part-time as well. So it ends up giving me a really broad understanding of a lot of issues, but also a broad skill set.
So what would you say then, looking to where your career is now, what would you say are the most common misconceptions about being an MP?
I think probably the hardest misconception is that people think that if we're elected that we are in control and we can change the law. We have two MPs in New South Wales, and we also have a Liberal national government, and the National Party are almost the opposite of the Animal Justice Party. So the government makes the decisions and we have to try to convince them to put legislation into what we want it to look like with two of us, with two votes. So a lot of people say, why haven't you done this yet? Or why aren't battery cages made illegal yet? And they don't realise that, you know, a lot of the work that we do is building political power, building that political capital, working with some of the major parties. And you know, there are issues where we can talk to people, we can get Labor on side, and then we can get the Greens on side. And then, you know, in our upper house at the moment, for me to get something passed, I have to get Labor and the Greens, but then I have to get at least one more. And my choice of one more is the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party or One Nation or Fred Nile from the Christian Democrats. So for me to pass anything, so every time we say we've passed something, it means we've convinced one of those parties to support us on an issue. So you can imagine, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to get issues on like in regards to animal agribusiness, but we might be able to get some stuff across the line on penalties for animal abuse, or we might get, last year we did a whole lot of work around domestic violence and animal abuse, and that requires us to get that broad support.
Can we talk about, let's say, three or four of the Animal Justice Party's goals?
Absolutely. So, look, I guess one of our goals is to grow as a political party. The bigger that we are and the more representatives we have, both on a local government, a state government, and even a federal level, the bigger voice that we have and the more power we have to be able to change things for animals. So one of our bigger long-term goals is to grow as a political force. Another major thing of ours, and I guess this comes back to our effectiveness, is really recognising the issue of having animal protection issues under the agriculture minister's portfolio. So it's very difficult when the minister that is in charge of protecting primary industries, so protecting the very industries that use and abuse animals, and also then looking after animal welfare. So we've got this massive conflict of interest, and it's almost impossible to get any major huge change for animals while that portfolio still sits under those ministers. So I think a real long-term goal, and I think that falls into this whole idea of an independent office of animal protection. We need that federally and in each state. We need the portfolio for animal welfare to go under a different minister, whether that's the minister for police, whether it's a separate portfolio, whether it falls under environment. I'm not sure exactly at this point in time how that will look, but we need a massive shakeup. And then we can start looking towards, removing all these government subsidies to prop up industries, particularly industries that are dying, like the dairy industry. We know that there's been a major consumer shift. I've just finished an inquiry, actually, in the upper house with the dairy industry asking for more subsidies because they're not making enough money. So that's obviously our taxpayers' money going to prop up an industry that consumers don't want anymore for a variety of reasons. And that's why we need a political voice for animals, as well as, those corporate campaigners and those individual behaviour change campaigners, because we need to sort out some of those subsidies. And we need to be moving those subsidies to help farmers transition out of animal agribusiness and towards some of these plant-based proteins. And there's so much innovation and technology there. We could be a world leader here in Australia. We're one of the fastest growing vegan markets in the world. And the other fastest growing vegan markets in the world are our neighbours at the United Arab Emirates and in right across Asia as well. So we could be building jobs by focusing on that plant-based protein market and building wealth in our country.
What vision do you have for the next 5 years?
Again, I think for the next 5 years, look, I guess it will fall under two categories. It falls under what can we actually change now, and what do we need to start the conversations for that change? So what I was just talking about as far as the entire political party, I mean, these are really big picture changes that we need to work towards. But I think half of our work is starting those conversations, trying to work out how they fit and start to campaign for those things. But the other half, what we can do is what can we change now? What needs to be put on the table that we might actually get some success at? So in New South Wales, we have some of the weakest penalties for animal cruelty. It's a maximum of $5,500 for an act of animal cruelty. In Victoria, I think it's $40,000. So we need to take animal cruelty very seriously. We need to recognise it as a very serious crime, and we need to jack up those penalties to reflect how serious of a crime animal cruelty is. So we actually tabled legislation to increase the penalties, and in response, the government has tabled their own legislation to increase the penalties as well, which is really fantastic news. It means that we were able to wedge them on this issue and force them to act on it. We also, I mentioned the domestic violence and animal abuse reforms. We had $500,000 going to refuges to upgrade their facilities to be able to house animals fleeing violence as well. We also had the use of animal abuse now recognised as a form of domestic violence. And there's a range of other issues as well that we think we might start to get some movement on. I've been working on the issue of crush videos, which is a fetish animal abuse video. It's not, and again, I think some of these things are just loopholes that that nobody within Parliament has ever actually considered before, that it's not illegal to possess these videos. And so, you know, it's finding some of those and actually trying to convince the government that we need to move on them.
We've been watching closely, and we see actually almost weekly things changing in New South Wales and Victoria, and hopefully soon it will be across Australia.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're getting close to elections, and we're struggling to understand how to vote, and are we voting above the line or below the line? Do you think the voting system in Australia needs to be either made simpler, or do we need a campaign to educate and give a greater understanding about the preferential voting and proportional representation?
I think that we need a bit of both. I think that we need to bring politics into high school, and I think that it's just missing. I mean, until I got really heavily involved in politics, I didn't understand a lot of the different aspects of it. And we're not taught this in high school. We're not even taught how to vote in high school. I think that nobody should be leaving high school without actually knowing how to fill in these forms. But it also needs to be simplified. And I think that the complexity is that it's different in every single state. So in New South Wales, and one of the most common questions I get is, who do your preferences go to? Now, we don't have a preference system in New South Wales. So often what people think of when they think of a preference system is that if they vote for the Animal Justice Party and I don't get in, that I have chosen who their vote goes to after me. And that's not the case. When we talk about preferences in New South Wales, it's actually about who we suggest on those how to vote cards that we hand out, who we would suggest would be further down in that list. But nobody has to follow a how to vote card. So in New South Wales, you choose your own second, third, fourth preference, for example. But that's not the same in every other state. And so I think we need to simplify it by having the same system across the country. And I think that there needs to be a lot more education in high schools so that people understand politics and also understand how to vote.
So thinking and looking at sort of the fossil fuels, and or fossil fuel lobby, their grasp on some key politicians, not putting you in there, obviously. but with the public's change in views on climate change, do you think that their grip is loosening on these politicians?
Yeah, look, I think it's inevitable. I think that a lot of these politicians, and if they're taking a lot of money from these lobby groups and they're being so heavily influenced by them, that they have to weigh up, will I get re-elected if I continue to do this? And so as the public pressure builds, the grip of these lobby groups switch. But the other interesting aspect of this, and I guess this is something that I've become more and more aware of, is that the lobby groups for animal agribusiness, because with the fossil fuel industries, you know, they've got a lot of money and they've got really expensive lobbyists that, you know, work very hard and they do this professionally. But with the animal agribusiness, they have that, but they also have key electorates where farmers dominate an entire electorate seat, which are now being fought between the National Party, the Shooters, even the Greens are hoping to get some of these voting electorates, which are very heavily farm-based. And so it's almost, it becomes very difficult to talk about the environmental impact of animal agribusiness because people don't want to talk about it in the other political parties because they want to still keep the opportunity to try to win some of these seats off other parties in heavily farming-based industries.
Yeah. So part of the Animal Justice Party's role is lobbying government, or a very large part of it. Could you sort of tell us some of the things you're working on at the moment, or some of the key ones that you want to push, obviously having mentioned some before?
Look, there's quite a few, and we've got our state office here in New South Wales who does a lot of our campaigning, and we also have a large range of regional groups throughout New South Wales. So these are volunteers that want to get involved and members. And that's such an important resource to be able for us to be able to work together with me as an MP and with them on the ground. And to give you a couple of examples, one that we're about to move into is the use of shark nets. And so we know with a Liberal national government, for example, it's very difficult for us to get rid of shark nets. But we, with our regional groups that are living in some of these beach areas under the council where there are shark nets, they can lobby their council and the council can agree to contact state government and say, we don't want the community in our council don't want these shark nets. They want non-lethal alternatives instead. And so as we build up that sort of local government pressure, that can really sort of have that upward effect. And we've done the same with circuses. We've done the same with fur. I think we've got about five or six councils now that have banned the sale of fur within council land. And that came after our notice of motion condemning the fur industry last year, which actually passed. It passed with the support of Labor and the Greens and the Christian Democrats. So, you know, but the government didn't support our notice of motion condemning fur. So we needed to show them that actually there is this bigger support. And of course, if we end up with a different government, if we end up with a Labor government, they've already made their position on this because a lot of the councils that are now moving to ban fur are Labor focused councils, and Labor and the state government supported our notice of motion. So it does mean that now we're starting to push at least one of the major parties towards some of these animal friendly policies as well.
That's great. So looking at them and sort of your work to abolish the likes of the exotic animal trade and the mink fur industry, besides the enormous loss of animal life these industries engaging, we're now seeing the devastating effects from human and animal interactions, clearly shown obviously with COVID-19. Has the New South Wales government started to rethink current practices because of this?
Unfortunately, no. It's a real head in the sand approach. I've done notices of motion on this, which have sort of had very little response. I have asked ministers questions in budget estimates, and it's really denial, denial, denial. And I think it really goes back to this whole, like the lobbyists, the money, and of course the elections and the votes. And unfortunately, I think it just sits on that. And so it is conversations that we're having and we will continue to bring up. But there's just been absolute denial and head in the sand, unfortunately, with the government and with Labor as well, I found.
So I guess it really strengthens the point then that you made that it is in everybody's hands. If we do talk to our local MPs, we do talk to our local councils, and we do start all talking out and saying that we want these changes to be made, eventually national government are going to have to listen if they want to maintain their roles and maintain their jobs.
And I think that, you know, another really important aspect which I have found in Parliament, and I didn't realise how bad it was until I actually got into Parliament, that there are lobby groups on almost every single issue. You know, there are lobby groups for women, there are lobby groups for animal agribusiness, there are lobby groups for the environment. But every time that there's an animal issue that comes up, the halls of Parliament are completely silent, and that's really difficult because even though there are other political parties that take on these issues, the political parties themselves aren't doing the lobbying as well. There's often external groups that are doing the lobbying for them on a lot of these issues. But there are no lobby groups in Australia or in New South Wales that come into Parliament to lobby on behalf of animals. And it's a gap within our entire movement. It's a gap that we really need to change.
Is that something that, say, you or the party could start to action throughout others? I mean, one of the things I've noticed is that we have a lot of charities around Australia working in Australia for animals, for climate and everything else. But I'm not seeing a great deal of collaboration between them. They all seem to have very much their own agenda rather than a joint agenda where they could go with the masses and say, look, all of us feel this. All of us want this to change. But it's almost we need somebody to come in above the lot of them and say, look, let's make a group, one group, we can have a much more powerful voice.
Yeah, I think that there definitely needs to be some more collaboration. And I think that some of the other issue is, and look, it's complicated and I can only kind of make assumptions here, but the majority of animal protection groups are very heavily focused on corporate change and individual behaviour change. And there's almost like this nervousness to step into that lobbying aspect. It's almost like a taboo to go and do that. And I know that there's even charities who are quite frightened to do that because, you know, there's been threats from other parties that they will lose their charitable status if they become a lobby group. And I think that that's hugely problematic, and we need to overcome that, and we need to work more closely together, and we need to recognise that we need corporate change and individual change and political change if we're going to get to a better place for animals.
It's surprising that there was a lobby group for the environment, but that is not connected to the animals at all. It's such a massive connection between animals and especially wildlife and the environment, and they don't come together at the moment.
We do have a couple of like environmental groups that will talk about koalas or that will talk about, you know, platypus. Like, so there is a little bit of, and there's obviously there's a huge connection between protecting, you know, native forests and trees and for the animals that live in those trees. But, you know, once you start to sort of go into areas of animal agribusiness, once you start talking about the use of animals in experimentation or for leather or fur or all these other issues, that's where there's dead silence.
And yet most of the deforestation occurs of animal agriculture. So it's such a strong connection.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So talking about it, and talking about animal factory farming and its devastating effects on natural habitats and deforestation and water courses, what is your view on this? Is there an opportunity that we can actually connect the environment issues that we have in Australia to the animal agriculture and fisheries?
Absolutely, and we absolutely have to. I mean, we know that the animal agribusiness is one of the leading causes of climate change, and we need to really get that on the agenda. It's almost, you know, as the environmental movement has grown bigger, and I think that's really great and it's really exciting, there's almost like a small pocket within the environment movement that are trying to make talking about that a taboo and saying, look, let's just ignore that issue for now and focus on some of these other issues. But they're all important, and you know, it is an uncomfortable truth, but everything has to be on the table if we're going to overcome this and to make sure that there's a survival of this planet.
I was reading a few days ago, and actually I think Gareth read it as well. It's a book called Operation Sustainable, mm-hmm. and it's written by a scientist from the UK. He goes through four steps to become sustainable, and one of them is a plant-based diet.
Yeah.
I think there's more and more out there about becoming vegan or adopting a plant-based diet for the environment. And yet it's mostly through social media, never mentioned in government, never mentioned in politics, apart from obviously Animal Justice Party.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're also seeing a lot more zoonotic diseases mm-hmm. and outbreaks globally. We've heard, I think, just a week or two ago, the outbreak of avian flu in Russia and the first human transmission. There's hundreds of cases, especially this past year, of avian flu, swine flu across the world, contaminating the wildlife as well. How do you see the government tackling this? Has there been any mention about it? Are there any talks about this at the moment or not?
Again, very frustratingly, it's a real head in the sand response to this. I actually did a interview. I did some Facebook Lives during lockdown, and I interviewed Dr. Michael Greger, who's the author of How Not to Die. And he also recently wrote a book, How to Survive a Pandemic. And he said, you know, the next pandemic we see will probably come from the poultry industry and could wipe out half of the entire human population. I mean, this is scary stuff. And it's actually quite frightening that the government is ignoring this. I mean, it's almost hard for the government to even grapple and accept the fact that this was a zoonotic disease. This is core, this disease that this outbreak that we had of COVID-19 was caused by the mistreatment and confinement of animals. And so many before it were as well. You know, during COVID-19, I'm sure we all saw the memes with the list of different other zoonotic diseases which caused you know, major outbreaks. You know, in budget estimates, yesterday I was speaking with the health minister and I asked him, why are slaughterhouse workers considered a top priority for COVID vaccines? And I mean, I know what the answer is, but I wanted to hear him say it. And I mean, the answer that was given was bizarre. It was like that, that people often that work in slaughterhouses don't speak English and they're in close confinement. And I said, well, you don't think that it has something to do with the fact that they're around diseased, sick animals that are terrified, that are dying, and blood and guts? And he said, oh, no, I've never seen any evidence that it has anything to do with that.
Yeah, there's been cases all over the world of contamination in slaughterhouses.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really clear. And I did actually, I mean, to his credit, I did sort of mention a journal article that explained it, and he asked me to deliver it to his office so he could have a read of it. But it does sort of go to show, you know, just this head in the sand mentality around this, which is frightening, really.
It is. We're playing with the lives of many, I think, mm-hmm. on this. I understand that AJPR are doing a lot of work on maintaining and expanding marine wildlife protection. Can you tell us more about it and also perhaps explain how important it is for us as humans?
Absolutely. So my office is doing quite a few things. As I mentioned, we've got the work around shark nets, and, you know, shark nets kill not just sharks, but a whole range of species that aren't even targeted with those nets. So we're trying to get rid of those nets. Another thing that we did just recently, I introduced a bill that recognises aquatic animals as animals, which sounds absurd, but at the moment, octopuses, crustaceans, they're not even recognised in New South Wales as animals under our Protection of Cruelty to Animals Act, which means that they don't even get the most our Protection of Cruelty to Animals Act is very basic. It's already failing animals, but to have certain species of animal excluded even from those very basic protections is really a big issue. So we actually tabled some legislation to change that and talked in Parliament about, you know, the sentience of these animals and their ability to feel pain. And it was actually when I was writing my speech for that legislation that I found a quote from a National Party MP in Parliament. I think it was in 2012 or something, a long time ago, and he was saying the same thing. He was asking why these animals were excluded from the Protection of Cruelty to Animals Act and actually advocating for them and saying, we know they feel pain and they should be included. And here we are in 2021 and they're still not included. So it's something that we will campaign heavily on. And you never know, given that it was a National Party MP that brought it up in Parliament many, many years ago, we might be able to get somewhere with that as well.
I was reading an article just this morning about cuttlefish passing a cognitive test meant for children.
Yes, it was at the marshmallow test.
Yes.
Yes, I saw that yesterday.
Obviously more to it. Definitely more to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
So how would you say Australia's stand or the current government's stand on their policy for animal protection, as minimal as it is? How do we stand in comparison to lots of the other developed countries? Are we about the same? Are we far behind? Where do we stand?
Look, I feel like Australia is sometimes one of the last to get on with things. I mean, the fact that we still have animals in circuses, you know, the UK and the US have moved to get animals out of circus style tricks. We obviously, there's the live export trade, which is continuing on. And yet then sometimes we can get somewhere where I'm seeing other countries haven't. So it's really quite hard to juggle it. And I think especially if we start to look at it Australia wide, you know, like the ACT has done some really great stuff for animals. They've recognised the sentience of animals. They've banned the use of battery cages. And so, you know, like there are some states that have done some good things. And as you mentioned at the beginning of our talk, you know, there's some great stuff that's happening in Victoria for animals. Just a few weeks ago in New South Wales, we banned the breeding of cetaceans for entertainment. So that was a really big win. But now we've still got Queensland. So Queensland's now the only state left in Australia still breeding these animals for circus style tricks. I mean, if we can get Queensland over the line to make sure that no more animals are born into this industry, then that helps us progress entirely as a country. But I think it's going to be a real big uphill battle because of the power and the strength of the company in Queensland that is breeding these animals. You know, look, these are big campaigns. You know, in Canada and in France, we saw them ban the breeding and the use of cetaceans in entertainment. And that was in the lead up to our ban in New South Wales as well. So, look, I always look at to see what's happening overseas to help me guide my own legislation and what we can fight for. We do often seem to be a couple of steps behind, but I mean, everything is so different. It's so state-based. You know, like there's jumps racing in Victoria, but there's no jumps racing in New South Wales. So each state in Australia just seems to be all over the place in their animal protection laws, and that makes it more and more difficult to compare.
So have you seen in your time as an MP or getting to an MP, have you seen a change in the government's reaction or attitude to animal and animal justice?
Absolutely. I have definitely seen a big change, and particularly with some of the one-on-one conversations I have with different MPs, you know, across all the different political parties. Last year, I actually did, I can't remember the exact number, but I did several hundred notices of motion. So you can do as many notices of motion as you want. And so I did every single aspect of the animal agribusiness industry. So every morning when I only did sort of two or three a day, but it led to a huge number at the end of the year. And a lot of them came up to me and they said, I didn't realize this or I didn't know about that. And people said, I can see what you're doing. You're using the notice of motion as an educational tool, but most of us have never heard any of this stuff before. Now we understand why the Animal Justice Party is in Parliament. And it has opened their minds, but also just our conversations with them and asking them to consider animals and to think about animals. And also, I think it's made a really big difference once I got elected. You know, I think that when it was just Mark Pearson MP, they were thinking maybe they're going to be a one-hit wonder, he'll be done in his time and then that'll be the end of it. But the fact that now we've got two, the fact that we've just got some councillors in Victoria, and hopefully this year we'll get some councillors in New South Wales, they'll realise that we're here to stay, and that means that going forward they're going to have to work with us, because as long as the government doesn't have the full numbers in the upper house to pass everything, they have to work with the crossbench, and that's where we have our power.
So with the change in American government, Australia's government are now kind of in the headlights. They've got no huge overweight climate denier in the way to block it. As a country, we're starting, I think, and many of others we've spoken to look a little bit like a climate change pariah. How do you think this change is going to affect the current government or future governments and their, well, I guess, inaction?
I think that, you know, and I go back to that comment where Australia always sort of seems to be lagging behind. I think what I've seen as a pattern is that there's a resistance, there's a pushback, and we're going to keep doing it our way. And then eventually they kind of accept it and start moving in the right direction. And I guess our role is to move that as quickly as possible, is to make them not be able to sit back. Because obviously, I mean, when we're talking about climate change, we're really talking about a ticking time bomb. And so it really is about, you know, like there's the opposition to us who are always trying to put up roadblocks to try to slow the process down. Last year, the Environment Minister in New South Wales actually put up a renewable energies bill. And One Nation actually put up so many amendments to the bill that it would take months to debate them. So what we decided to do was to sit in Parliament, and so I think it was a Tuesday, or a, I think it was a Tuesday, and then it stayed as Tuesday technically until we finished. So we were there for 30 hours, And so basically basically we were making sure that One Nation kind of stopped putting up amendments and ended up putting them in globo and doing them together so that the bill could pass. And that ensured that New South Wales is going to 80% renewable. We still think we can go to 100%, but we were willing to work with the government who had got it to at least 80%. But to be able to do that, you know, when One Nation and the Shooters and Fishers are pushing for coal and pushing for nuclear, we needed to actually, in an odd situation, work with the government to push for renewables. So, you know, our position is to get us there as quickly as possible. And it was actually a really good opportunity at the end of the year to be able to work with the government and Labor and the Greens in unison to make sure that this bill passes.
Absolutely. And it's so strange because if you read the facts are renewables are now more cost effective per kilowatt than any fossil fuel that's out there. And then we get the other daft thing where we get the so-called natural gas, which is a methane-based gas, which is so incredibly damaging to our atmosphere, more damaging per ton than carbon. But the marketing is very, very good. And so it's very frustrating to constantly being pushed back by that. I take my hat off to you. I don't know how you keep going at it.
It's worth it, I think.
It definitely was worth it. We need that. We need people like you fighting for us, really, as we don't stand the chance. I was going to ask if there are any other things that we should know about AJP, but one of the things that you've just talked about, that climate change, working for that change, one of them. Any other parts of your work that does not only align with justice and it aligns with climate change and other factors?
So climate change and environmental protection is a huge part of the work that we do. And obviously, you know, the two are so interrelated. I mean, there's nowhere for animals to live if we deforest everywhere and, you know, major land clearing, habitat loss. It's a massive thing for animals. And obviously we also recognise humans as animals. We're just another species of animal. So we do have we go by, you know, compassion, rationality and nonviolence. So we use that within all of our decision making. You know, I think I mentioned last year we did a whole lot of work around domestic violence and animal abuse. So finding some of those areas where there's that interconnection that have been ignored. It was interesting. I also put up an amendment last year on strata bylaws after there was some retrospective bylaws that were pushing people out of their apartments that they owned during COVID because they had an animal living with them. And it wasn't until, you know, our amendment passed and then we had this big fight with the government because they had to agree to it. I realised how big of an issue this was because people with disability were getting discriminated when they were applying to go into strata complexes with companion animals. People within domestic violence were having housing access issues because of strata laws that blocked them from having animals. I mean, the issues just grew and grew, and I realised that this is not just, you know, wanting to have your furry friend with you, but it's so much more than that, and it was quite complex, and there was a lot of human rights issues pulled into that as well.
Brilliant. So where should people go to learn more about AJP, and how can they reach you?
So they can reach me. I have my own website, emmahurstmp.com. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. You can message us on Facebook at any time. Animal Justice Party also has their own social media pages as well. We have a state office in New South Wales. So if you reach out to the state office, if you actually become a member of Animal Justice Party New South Wales, you can join one of our regional groups and actually get active within the campaigns. We have 13 regional groups across New South Wales. If you're in an area where there is no regional group, we're always looking for people to set up new regional groups as well. And we do, as I said, you know, we've got the Sharknet campaign, the Circus campaign, the Fur campaign. So we work quite closely with our regional groups on a lot of our campaign issues as well. And yeah, reach out to us. There's also obviously the National Party. If you become a member, you can come to our Animal Justice Party conferences. And if you really want to get involved, you can try to elect yourself to become a delegate who can then vote on our policies and get really heavily involved with the party. And run, obviously, for councils and for and as MPs as well. I'd really like to see some more women putting up their hand to run as elected members and represent the party.
So on a more personal side for yourself, understanding the climate emergency, what is it that keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I guess it's just, you know, recognising the damage that the animal agribusiness is doing to our climate. You know, one of the single biggest things that we can all do is change our behaviour. But, you know, while the government is providing these subsidies to prop up these industries, you know, we just need massive change. We need a major shift. We need a transition. And, you know, I think the complexity within this, and this is, you know, I often do wake up and start thinking in the middle of the night, and it's really about how do we get there? Because we need to get there with people. And, you know, there's a lot of anger and frustration for, you know, the people who are working in animal agribusiness, for example, and we need to overcome that. It can't be you versus us. If we're going to get to a solution, we need to find a way to work together, and that might be moving some of these subsidies away from propping up these industries and actually helping those farmers to transition to sustainable plant-based farming. I did a wonderful interview with a former dairy farmer, and she actually came to our Upper House Dairy Inquiry and spoke very honestly about the cruelty in the industry, the health effects that she's now learnt about after exiting the industry. And she talked really strongly about this need for a government-assisted transition for farmers. And she said, you know, a lot of these people have great skill sets. A lot of them, you know, wanting to push away what happens to these animals and trying to not recognise it. But if we worked with them, I mean, if they're in an industry that's already collapsing, but there is this government assistance, then I think we can get to where we need to be much faster.
So to turn it around then, what makes you most optimistic for the future?
I think just seeing, you know, like I guess there's two things. There's seeing some of these small changes. So seeing, you know, an end to the breeding of cetaceans and entertainment, you know, our domestic violence reforms that we passed last year, I've just passed now in Victoria as well. So a lot of these small wins show that we're actually getting somewhere and that we're having some influence. But then the other aspect that kind of excites me is looking to see what's happening overseas, just in this whole plant-based movement and this growth that we're seeing. And we're seeing major investments, major new companies that are really going to be global leaders and really push this massive change, because we need that consumer change and we need that corporate change, and that's going to lift up that political change that we need.
Finally, if there is one thing that we can change that will make a massive effect on our planet, what would that be? How can we be good?
Definitely to go vegan, for your own health, for the animals, and obviously for the planet as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I don't know how you do it. Like I said before, with so many members of government with their head in the sand and you inevitably almost having to bang your head against the wall to get them to change. Yes, I've got nothing but admiration for what you do and the energy to carry on doing it. So thank you very, very much for joining us and sharing.
Thank you. Thank you.
What a great guest. And I can imagine how frustrating it must be when both the federal and state governments have their head in the sand and she's trying to make such a huge difference in the world.
Indeed, indeed. And I think we need to consider we have local elections soon and national elections. And it's worth considering protecting our environment and our wild animals, as well as looking for green energy and stopping fossil fuels.
Absolutely. We've got to look very clearly into their policies and how they're going to help the planet as a whole.
And we also have another item on our How to Be Good list. Go vegan for the animals, for our own health and for the planet too.
And if you're looking to try and go vegan or you're struggling, get in touch with us. We're going to be doing a full episode about veganism soon and would love to hear your views. So please subscribe and review the podcast so we can keep doing what we're doing. And we're really looking forward to our next one. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.